Welcome to a Listen to Older Voices Golden Moments program.
I'm brought to you through the Toorak Times.
This is a repeat program from our archives that we believe has merit enough to rebroadcast so that the story and the person's life can be shared with those who may have missed it the first time.
This is the story of Dougal Moyes, which was originally aired in June of 2005.
Hello, I'm Rob Greaves and welcome to part two of my talk with Dougal Moyes. Last week, Dougal took us through his early years as he grew up as a young boy during the Great Depression, a difficult time for him and his family. However, he followed his childhood ambition to become a teacher and became a student teacher at the age of 16. In this final part of his story, Dougal puts his teaching career on hold and joins the war effort, but not as a pilot, which he really wanted to be, but as an interpreter in New Guinea. How did this happen? Well, listen, because the story is fascinating. Now to Dougal, who finishes off his story of his student teaching adventures by reminding us that it still wasn't an easy life.
I'd won a teaching scholarship worth £10 to buy books. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been able to afford it.
Yes.
Anyhow, I was only 16 because you would have called up in when you were 18.
Right.
And I had... I wasn't nowhere near being called up. I was 16 and I was appointed a student teacher at Long Worry.
At 16 years of age?
16, yeah. A student teacher.
Yes.
You were only the tea boy, more or less, in the staff room. So I had to ride my bike 11 miles down to Long Worry.
Goodness.
And back again at night, and then milk cows, of course, before we left. And so that we did things like that. We had to. So I was down there for one term, and then I was shifted up to Nilma, which is all right. It was only 5 or 3 or 4 miles the other side, east of Warrigal. That was a lot easier. Now, the day I arrived at Nilma, a relieving head teacher was appointed to Nilma, so he and I arrived the same day. Now, he was there for about a week, and I turned up on the Monday morning. I didn't have a key to the school and so forth, so I was playing with the kids. We were kicking the football around, waiting for this relieving teacher to jolly well open up the school and let it get started. And the lady from next door, who used to clean the school, came over and said, "Look, it's 10 o'clock. You should be in school." I said, "Well, I haven't got a key, and the relieving teacher's not here." So she said, "Oh, I've got a key." So she opened it up, and I got the kids in, and we all got working away. And that evening, the relieving teacher was living in one of the hotels, the commercial hotel in Warrigal, I think. So I went in there, and here he is in bed. No, he's too sick to go teaching. And he said to me, "Well, you get on to the inspector and tell him that you can't take the school." So I did nothing of the sort. The next day I went out there and I opened up. I had the key. I had his key. Mm. And I opened up and I started the school, and I was there for a whole term on my own.
Goodness.
And old Tom Reddy used to teach us at Nairn South. He met the mother one Thursday in Warrigal. Thursday was the market day in at Warrigal, and the stall holders and so forth used to come up from the Dandenong and Oakley, Croydon markets with their fruit and things. Warrigal was a big market day on Thursdays. So the mother and Tom Redding had a chat. They knew each other from near and south. And the mother told Tom that I was on my own out at Nilma. So Tom got in his car and came tearing out, and here I am with 30-odd kids in one room.
Goodness.
And I had no training whatsoever, of course. So that was all right. And they left me there for the whole term. Now, I didn't get any higher pay or anything. I got a letter eventually thanking me for carrying on. no higher pay.
No, well, you can't go and buy groceries with the letter.
No, but I really enjoyed that.
Yes.
And then eventually I was appointed temporary head teacher of a little school, Mount Butte, B-U-T-E, down the Western District between Lismore and Skipton. And there were 30-odd kids there, and the eldest, he was about a year younger than I was. He had to call me Mister. I thought that was really good. Oh, yes. I lived in the nearest farmyard, farmhouse, with people by the name of Harry James, and so forth. And I was down there quite a long while. I really enjoyed that. One teacher school, a little rural school.
Yes, of course.
And the kids used to come by horse and jinker and bicycle and so forth. There were stables. There were stables there, so that was all right. And eventually I applied to join the Air Force's air crew.
Right.
You could join the Air Force at 18 and the Navy at 18, but you couldn't join the AIF at 18. You had to wait till you were 19. You could be called up to the militia forces, AMF, at 18. I didn't want that. Like all kids, I wanted to be a pilot.
Of course.
I, who had never driven a motor car, hardly ever been in a motor car. So I was called up. And I went down to Laverton, and some silly clot down somewhere down there was looking through your enlistment papers, and he saw that I'd put myself down as to speak and read Japanese. So I was called up, and I said, yes, that's right. And so the next day I was put on the Spirit of Progress, up to Albury, changed trains to Sydney. So I was sent to Sydney University. Professor Sadler, he was Professor of Oriental Studies. So I was there for quite a while, a few weeks, and we went through pronunciation and grammar and reading kanji and characters and things like that. I was then appointed more or less as an interpreter translator.
Oh, okay.
I was made a sergeant. Oh, crikey, eh?
That was a quick promotion.
It was a quick promotion, but that was about all the promotion I ever got. So I was then put on a troop train to Brisbane. Oh, yes, and at Brisbane, I went out to Gaythorn. There was a POW camp at Gaythorn. Now, the Coral Sea battle had taken place, and a few Japanese marines had been picked up out of the water, and they were kept at Gaythorn. So I went there for a few days just talking to them. Ooh. So that I could get used to seeing what they looked like. I'd never seen a Japanese in my life.
Right.
There were none in Gippsland.
No.
No, worry. So then I was on a troop train to Townsville. We got to Townsville. Then swapped over onto a short Sunderland flying boat. Those four, it used to be one of the old Empire Airways Qantas flying boats that used to fly from England to Australia.
Yes.
So we flew up to Cooktown, and from Cooktown we stayed there until it got dark, and then we snuck over to Moresby. So I landed at Moresby, and from Moresby, the next day, we flew up to Wau, Bulola, you know, the gold mining place, because the Japanese had landed at Lae and Salamoa. I better come back and tell you how I got under Japanese.
Please do. Now, Dougal has handed me a book here, The New Testament, Modern English and Japanese.
Yes. You've heard of the Gideon Society, have you?
Of course.
That's where that came from.
Right.
Now, I told you there were four churches at Neuham Sound.
You did?
Right. Now, we We were Presbyterians. Yes. Now, the minister used to come out from Warrigal once a month.
Yes.
And there'd be about 10 of us in the congregation.
In congregation,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Oh, I suppose the whole lot were like that. The Reverend Fraser Sutherland used to take Bible study after the sermon. Right, now he gave all the boys, there were three or four of us boys there, we had to look up and find out about the life of certain Christian people.
Mm-hmm.
The brother had Shackleton,
mm-hmm.
Ernest Shackleton and so forth, and I was given a fellow, Kagawa. Now, Kagawa was a Japanese Christian. He'd been interned or something. He was protesting against Japanese atrocities in China or something. He'd been interned. It's a wonder he hadn't had his head chopped off.
Mm.
Kagawa. Now, the only way I could get Kagawa, the Gideons gave me a little bit of information about him. And they'd got it from the British and Foreign Bible Society down in Melbourne. And so there you are. It's got Japanese on one side, it's got English on the other.
Yes.
Now, all those Japanese writing, kanji, you see, I found them very mathematical. They're all pictures.
Yes, that's right.
So they're all pictures, all of those. This is the New Testament. So that's how I knew about 1,000 of those little cards. I used to make cards myself. I knew about 1,000 of those kanji. And that's why I put it down on my enlistment form. And that's why that clot down there stopped me from being an aircrew pilot.
Well, because you'd written and learned Japanese.
Yeah, well, I assumed that I did, but until I got to Sydney University, I'd never met one and never heard it.
Mm.
So that's why I spent weeks there with Professor Sadler. He was an old chap, oh, an old gentleman. He was a fine old fellow. Professor Sadler. Yeah.
So you could read it, but you'd never heard it spoken.
That's right. That's right.
This is Listen to Older Voices, and you're listening to a Golden Moments program.
Now, when the Japanese came down, they came down to Truk, made a big base at Truk, and then they came down to Rabaul in New Britain. The 22nd boys were at Rabaul. And, of course, the Japanese overrun them.
Mm.
And quite a few of them were captured down at Toll Plantation. and they were taken out in the scrub, and the Japs blooded their troops by bayoneting our fellows. Eventually, when we're interpreting POWs and reading diaries and things like that, we always had a list of names of Japanese that the natives sort of told us about, their atrocities. So we always had a list. We were always checking up if we'd caught them or got them, or whether they were dead or alive, and things like that. So you always had a list of that. Anyhow, from Rabaul, before they got into New Guinea, they landed over, or they were still in New Guinea, that they landed over at Lae and Salamoa. Now, Lae was in walking distance, 2 day walking distance of Wau. Now, I went over to Wau with the 2nd 5th Independent Company. Now, all the old New Guinea hands, the miners, the gold miners and so forth, they had all been conscripted into New Guinea force. They were all called up in army and so forth. Now, there was a scratch mob of them, and they made a raid on Salamoa, which is occupied by the Japanese.
Yes.
Salamoa was a kind of an isthmus south of Lae. Lae, at that time, was supposed to be the capital after Rabaul had been more or less destroyed by a volcano, ash and so forth. So they made a raid down on Salamoa. We didn't get any prisoners, and we didn't lose any men either.
Oh, that's
But we picked up quite a few documents, lots of documents. And they were brought back up to Wau, and that's where I started translating documents, Wau. And then a couple of them were operational documents, what we'd call routine or daily routine orders and so forth, which meant there was a they were going to put a patrol out to Mubol. Now, down near Mubol, we had a watching post. We also had another watching post around at Camp Diddy and so forth, watching over Lae. We had little folks, fellows here and there, all around the place. Now, I told the people at NGF at Wau that the Japanese are going to send a patrol out to Mubol. So we warned our watchers at Mubol, and they saw the Japanese coming along. They could get away from the Japanese if they had a 10-minute start.
Right.
These fellows had been in New Guinea all their lives, or most of their lives, after the First World War, anyhow. Now, at the same time, there was a wireless section at Mubol, and they informed Moresby of this raid. Now, 5th Air Force, that was the American Air Force, the 5th Air Force sent over a couple of Japanese maps of that.
These are your copies of the original maps?
Yes, yes.
Gosh.
There's Lae up there, and Salamoa. Yeah, hang on. Oh, I've even got artillery. That's Japanese artillery sketch maps. These have been picked up, you see.
Enemy is strong position.
Well, I'm getting right ahead of myself.
No, it doesn't matter. This is interesting.
You see, that was when they were treating way down near Deniki.
Right.
Going back to through Kokoda down to Bunagana. Now, this is another type of thing. You see, the Japs used to send in reinforcements in these little coastal vessels. You see, it's camouflage. Now, a B-26 has come through here and dropped its load, its bombs, and is photographing it. Now, the bloke behind is coming in and he's firing at it. Now, as he gets right over the top, the jolly bombs from the first bloke explode and blow this bloke in half. So half of him nosedives in there, you see. Mm. So we had, you see, we had to check up on all of these. Were there any, find out what Japanese troops were there.
Oh, right. So
right. You have to were there any survivors? Did you pick up any survivors? If not, okay. That type of thing. And all of these had to be checked up, you see. And that took hours.
Oh, I bet it did.
Yeah. Oh, crikey.
But every little bit of information was important, wasn't
it? Oh, yes. Yes. Oh, crikey. We had... you see, at the back of that's the translation of that.
Of the original, yes.
And this document here. That's the actual document.
These are the original Japanese documents.
That's the original Japanese document.
How are you allowed to keep these?
Oh,
yeah. You've got your ways. Okay, you had your ways. Yes. Amazing documents.
Yeah. Well, when it was translated, you see, there wasn't any information that was of any value.
Yes, right. You see? Yes, yes.
You see, these are their maps. This is the road down to Bulldog.
So you would get dozens and dozens of documents, and when you translated them, you didn't know whether they were useful.
We got tons of these documents, and you'd quickly read down here, for example. This is Okabe. This is Okabe. Shitai. Okabe attached forces. Japanese forces were often called after the name of the commander.
Okay.
Right? Instead of saying the 3rd Battalion or something like that, it was Okabe's. Now, there you are. Now, there's a couple of good ones. Now, these are for diaries. We often... Nikki's dig diaries.
Which could tell you a lot, couldn't they?
Oh, they did.
Yes.
And you read that, that'll tell you quite a bit.
Dougal's handed me a translation from some of the Japanese war diaries, and I will read a bit of it because it's really interesting. From diary of, I can't pronounce the Japanese, but it looks like Fumitashi Yasuka, number 1 Machine Gun Company, 18th of December 1942. No provisions. Some men are said to be eating the flesh of Tony, the captives. It is said to have a good flavour. That's sad and horrible.
It is. Yeah. Yes.
What was your reaction when you first translated that?
Oh, well, we knew that that type of thing is sort of typical because of the atrocities. You see, our dead were mutilated when we managed to get to them, and things like that. I went down to Nagwasawa when I was at WOW. We got information that there was a Japanese seriously wounded down at Bob's. Bob's was a station camp. Where our fellows used to pull in every now and again. So I went down there. It took a couple of days' walk to get there. And there was a Japanese there. He was almost finished. So you asked him his name, his rank, how did he get here? And you found out that they were bringing them in by dribs and drabs on these little boats that I showed you there. So, okay, we got a bit of information out of him, but he then finished up. And then the native from the near camp nearby came out and chopped him up because the Japs had been ill-treating the Maoris, the natives and things like that. So, see, we were only 20 by this time, 21. We're sort of used to the atrocities that went on.
It must, look, but to get to that point where you get used to it must have been awful, because you must have witnessed and heard so much.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, you see, I thought, you know, you'd interrogate them and in a friendly kind of way.
Mm.
No, it wasn't like that. No, it doesn't work like that. The first few, one or two that came down by aircraft, they were really bombastic. Japan had, you know, they'd come down thousands of miles from Tokyo. They were winning. They were winning. Everywhere they went, they were winning.
Mm.
They had a big win at Pearl Harbor. They had a big win at Rabaul. They had a big win in Malaya, Singapore. They were tremendous victories. Yeah, they were. To the Japanese, and we hadn't done a thing. We didn't do anything even in the Coral Sea.
Mm.
It was just a stalemate. It wasn't a real victory. Milne Bay was the first time that we ever had a victory over the Japanese. Yeah, Milne Bay. Yeah.
So they were thinking they were invincible.
They were. Well, so would we have been,
yes,
too.
Yes, yes.
I mean, see how cocky MacArthur was when he got back to the Philippines.
Yes.
He didn't care how many men he lost until he got there. Yes. And most of those fellows in New Guinea were Australians. They weren't Americans.
Yes.
They were Australians. Anyhow, I've had enough today.
Well, Dougal, thank you very much for sharing this part of your story with me. It's very okay. Touching. Thank you.
Yeah, doi toshimashite. Don't mention it. Dai niji sekai senso ne watakshi wa honyaksha tutsuyaksha deshita. There you are. You can put that in.
Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Uniting Victoria Tasmania. The program is funded from the Commonwealth and State Government's Home and Community Care Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.